Welcome to Changemakers Without Borders. I'm your host and producer, Mai Cooper, and with me is guest engineer and improv teacher, Bernie Roll, from the University of Waterloo. Welcome back. So you have helped build one of the theaters in Kitchener and in Ontario to teach people how to play improv called Theater on the Edge. How was it to build this theater and what made you build it?
Well, it's interesting. The group began back in 1981 when some students from the University of Waterloo went on a co-op work term in Vancouver, saw improv there, and they came back and said, we can totally do this. And so they contacted myself and a few other people, and we started doing workshops together and then started doing shows. And at that time, the bar was pretty low because no one had ever seen improv here before. So the fact they were able to do it at all was impressive. And then by the time people had higher expectations, we had gotten better. So it was very easy for us to get started. And we've been going really ever since. And here it is. Well, it's 2020 now, so this will be our 39th year doing improvisation in Waterloo. Wow.
Amazing. So what is improv from your point of view?
Improv is creating things out of thin air, using nothing but your imagination. It's a very creative process. It's also a very collaborative process. You're always working with other people. So we're working with another person to create some scenario or play some kind of improv game, and an audience provides ideas as well. So the audience is always part of the show. They're contributing their ideas to start the scenes going.
Can you give me a quick example of an improv game, one of your favorites?
Gosh, there are so many. I'll give you a simple one. We'll do a short interview with an audience member where they talk about their life, just what they did that day. Any ordinary day. They got up in the morning, they had breakfast, went to work, and so on. And then we reenact that on stage. So one of us would play the person who gave us the information, and the rest would all play different characters in their day. And we will usually kind of embellish things a little bit to make it fun, but we'll basically try and stick to that story of what that person did that day.
And the other characters are the characters that the person was describing in the interview you've been asking.
Right. So if they say, yeah, I live with my parents and my brother, then two of the other actors will be the parents, one will be the brother. If they say, I have a cat, one of the actors might be the cat, and so on. At work, they might have coworkers or what have you. Whoever they mention in their day, the other actors would play those characters.
What do you think improv allows people to do?
To be creative. And that's so important because I think that is undervalued in our society. We don't prize creativity as much as we should. And a lot of people don't get a chance to exercise their creativity, ever. So we give them an outlet for that. We say, here's a chance for you to be completely creative and create things literally out of nothing. And once people get the hang of it, they really seem to enjoy it.
What would you say to a person who feels very uncreative, feels like they've, you know, especially for people who are working at a desk all day and who have maybe never done improv ever in their life.
Mm-hmm. I would say that you have creativity inside you. You've always had creativity inside you. You were born with creativity inside you. You just haven't had a chance to exercise it. And it's very much like a muscle, right? If I wanted to be super strong, I'd be exercising every day and working out my muscles. It's like that. The more you do improv, the easier it gets. The more you flex those creativity muscles. And starting out is always the most challenging part, but the more you do it, the easier it gets, much like a lot of other things.
What do you say makes somebody good? So, okay, so say somebody is able to break through their shell, mm-hmm. able to go out there and be a little crazy. What makes somebody good at improv?
I think there are a few core skills that people need to develop when they're learning improv. The first is listening, because you have to really pay attention to the person on stage with you, because that's your only source of information, right? You don't know what's going on unless the other person says something. So listening to what they say, accepting their ideas, and adding your own ideas to them, that is the core of all improvisation. And that is a very transferable skill set. If you can do that on stage, you can do that in life. You can learn to listen to what people are saying, really listen to them, add your own ideas to theirs, and create something. So if people are feeling uncreative in their daily lives, they can get into improv, learn to be creative on stage, and that transfers over to their real life.
Would you say that you would encourage people to learn improv for the sake of having better relationships with other people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here, you go to a company and you find they're brainstorming some new product or something, and they're sitting around a table. Someone says an idea, someone else says, well, that won't work because of this. Someone else says something, and someone else says, that won't work because of that. And 2 hours later, they've got absolutely nothing. They've gone around in circles and accomplished zero. Whereas if they start saying yes to each other's ideas and building on them, they'll wind up with something. So in a workplace, it's very helpful. If people are going for a job interview, having a positive mindset, listening and saying yes and can help them a lot. Going on a first date, people are often very nervous going on dates. This can help them a lot. They learn to listen to the person they're with and add to what that person is saying, and agree, and yes, and. So it's a very important skill set. In relationships, learning to listen to your partner, very important. Learning to add on to what they're trying to do, rather than take away from it, very important.
Do you see that in most cases, people who are starting off with improv, just at the very beginning, is it very hard for them to say yes to ideas?
It varies from one person to another. I've discovered that some people, for whatever reason, have been lucky enough to have been brought up in a very positive atmosphere, and they're used to saying yes to ideas, and they're rewarded for being creative. Other people, not so much. They were raised in perhaps a more negative environment, and they were told no all the time, and they were told they're not creative, and so they'd never practice those skills. So people come in kind of starting improv at different levels, but that's okay because over time, everyone kind of reaches the same level. Just a longer journey for some people than for others.
Would you say that it's a good idea to, like you were saying about companies, for between coworkers, to actually do improv workshops?
We've done those. Actually, we've been brought into a number of companies to teach them basic improv skills that they can then make use of in their workplace.
So I want to go back to a point you said about listening and basically active listening. Actually, listening is quite a hard skill. There are people who say that they listen, but many times when they listen, they're thinking about their own thoughts or thinking about the next thing that they could say, maybe against that person, especially in an argument. What would you say is something that could help people listen more?
Learning to listen for the content of what someone is saying rather than just listening for a pause that you can fill with your own thoughts, right? Some people say they're listening, and actually they're just waiting until the other person is done talking so they can say their thing. That's not listening. Listening is actually absorbing information the other person is giving to you, processing it, reacting to it, and saying something based on that back to them. So it's kind of a three-part process. Listen to what they say, internalize it, process it, and respond. And in improv, you learn to do that very quickly and fluidly. But it's a good skill to have, especially if you're arguing with someone about something. You have to listen and understand where they're coming from in order to know how to respond, right? And people often don't do that. They just tune out what the other person is saying and ignore it, and then just stick to their own point of view. And if both people are doing that, nothing happens. And the argument goes on and becomes circular and doesn't go anywhere. Whereas if they listen and find a way of saying yes to at least some part of what the person is giving them, then that takes them to the next step of the discussion.
Do you think that it might help people to internalize, like you were saying, the conversation, if they would write what the other person is saying to them so that they can actually, while writing, they're thinking about, okay, I have to write this in this word that this person is saying, or actually put it in my own words, whatever my friend or my partner is saying? Or do you think that, like, what is a good way of internalizing? Because I would say that sometimes we either, especially when arguing, we talk very fast, we can talk with a lot of anger, which if people are coming with trauma from their own childhood or things like this, it can block their ability to listen.
I think the idea of writing is interesting. If I have friends who are having a conflict with each other, I encourage them to resolve it by email initially, because they can take the time to get their thoughts in order, take the time to read the other person's words, and then respond. And of course, that's fraught with peril, because in email, a lot of the nuances are lost. Tone of voice, facial expression, so on. But it's a way of getting ideas down on paper. But in terms of having a real-time discussion, slowing down and writing everything out takes a long time and makes the entire thing very tedious.
Definitely.
Yes. I think the other idea you mentioned of repeating back to them is good. So when someone says something, you repeat back to them what you heard them say, paraphrasing it to make sure you've got the idea rather than just the words. And then, so someone says something, I might say, What I hear you saying is this. And so that verifies to them that I am listening, and it also validates my understanding of what they said. And they can say, no, that's not what I meant. And I say, good, let's find out what you actually meant and go from there. So I think it's a very, very useful process.
And in matter of listening in a different way, for example, with body language, mm-hmm. many times when we're listening to somebody, we could be very closed, mm-hmm. Arms crossed, or, mm-hmm. But also on stage, we might, in a way, forget the audience. What are some ways, especially when, for example, for professionals, when they're giving a presentation, their eye contact, what should they be doing with themselves, with their body, when they're giving a presentation, or on stage?
Sure. I mean, on stage and giving a presentation seem at first to be very similar. They're actually quite different. If we're doing an improvised scene, we're looking at each other. We're making eye contact with each other, the two performers on stage, while the audience watches. We want to kind of cheat our bodies out a little bit so we're not hidden from them, and we want to speak up a little bit so they can hear us. But aside from those small accommodations, we're still focused on each other. In a presentation, it's not one-to-one, it's one-to-many. So you're trying to communicate with a large number of people. So you want to be able to, if at all possible, see them and watch them. Because watching goes hand in hand with listening. You want to say, okay, are they fidgeting? Are they looking away? Are they leaning forwards because they're interested? What are they doing physically? And that'll tell you how effective you are at communicating with them. If they're kind of looking around bored, then you're probably giving the information to them at too slow a pace or going over things they already know. Whereas if they're leaning forwards, they're engaged, they're listening, and the things you're giving them are of value to them. So reading that is very important. In terms of what you do physically, I try and make eye contact at least once with everyone in the audience, assuming it's a small enough room. And I also try and keep my body very open to them. Because if my body is closed off, it's saying, yeah, I'm scared of you, or I'm threatening to you. Whereas if my body is open, it says, I'm not scared of you, you don't need to be scared of me. It's very open body language, very open communication.
Do you think that makes a big difference?
People pick up on it without realizing it. It's interesting to see. If I'm watching people and they're kind of held back a little bit, if I make a point of opening my body language to them, and people listening to podcasts cannot see this, but I'm doing that right now, they will gradually start to mirror that. They will relax because they're picking up on that cue without even realizing it consciously. I think it is something that matters.
I would say that probably helps as well with interviews. When you're going for a job interview, then it is a good idea to, as the person being interviewed, to come with open body language, to come also to do some de-stress, meditation, mm-hmm. or something before to help with interviews. Because it, basically, in almost every job, you will have a task that is related to human communication. Because until we have AI to do that for us, and even then, we will need to do that. And actually, for me and for you as well, it is more of a joy to speak with people than to deal with a computer. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to ask you a bit about relationships, mm-hmm. and in also professional and also personal relationships. Mm-hmm. What do you do in order to give feedback in a relationship to keep... For example, as a person who is teaching improv for the past 38 years, how do you give feedback to a person that you see is not perhaps getting the point mm-hmm. of what you're trying to bring across to them without them taking it too hard and without them being closed off after you give them a piece of criticism?
Sure. The first step is to realize that if they're not getting it, that's not necessarily their fault, because it takes me communicating clearly first. So I say, okay, if they're not getting it, what can I do to change what I'm doing to make their job easier? It's not all on the receiving person to receive better. It's also on the transmitter to send a clearer signal, to be more effective at communicating. You also, particularly in things like improv, where people are already kind of a little bit anxious, you want to relax them and calm them down. So you want to create an atmosphere in which they are receptive. If people are tense, they're not going to receive communication. They can't, right? They're closed off. But if they're feeling good and relaxed and safe, then they will absorb information, ideas, far more readily, and they'll be more willing to try things. So you say, well, what if you try doing this instead? They'll say, sure, rather than being defensive about it. So if you can find ways of putting them at ease, and this is true in anything, but I think more so even in improv, you want to make people relaxed. Tension is the enemy of creativity. So if they're feeling tensed, they're not going to be creative. They're not going to be able to do an improv exercise if they're up in their head, worried and stressed and tense. You want to relax them completely. And I'd rather have someone relaxed rather than too relaxed than not relaxed enough, right? You want to find a balance, but I always err on the side of being calm, being focused, because it just gets better results, I think.
Have you seen somebody who has been too relaxed at improv?
No, not really. Well, I take that back. There was someone I was in a workshop once a long time ago, and I was convinced they were stoned. It turned out they weren't. They're just a very mellow person. Very, very, very mellow person. And I thought, wow, okay, they need to get a little bit more engaged. They should be a little bit more anxious than they are, because right now they're basically a piece of furniture. So it is possible you be too mellow. But aside from those kind of extremes, I'd rather have people relaxed and having fun than have them all tense and stressed and all that.
So how do you help people perhaps not feel embarrassed? Because perhaps, you know, why do you think that, one of the number one fears of Americans is public speaking?
Right.
I would say that it is connected to public humiliation. They're afraid that they're going to say something wrong. Everybody's going to remember them for it. And especially with improv, it's not only your voice. Many times you're using your whole body, which many people could have passed through different things in their life that have made them ashamed of their body, or many different experiences that caused negative feelings.
I think the first step is to encourage people to be comfortable with who they are, right, as a performer. So bring yourself, your physical self, and your mind, your attitude, your voice, everything about you onto that stage. So getting people to be relaxed and comfortable in who they are is really important, because if they're worrying about those things, then they're not engaging with the other people in the scene, right? If they're thinking, you know, am I wearing the right thing, or you know, is my hair look right, is my clothes look right, am I body right, am I too big, am I too small, if they're obsessed with all those irrelevant things, then they're not going to be able to do their best job on stage. So I think that's a large part of it. And the interesting thing about improv is people worry about doing an unsuccessful scene and people will remember that. I guarantee that doesn't happen. People remember the entertaining, funny stuff, because we remember things that we associate with strong emotion. So if we're laughing and having a good time, we'll remember that. A bad improv scene is, by definition, unmemorable. There is nothing about it that stands out, so people will forget it minutes later. It's gone. Improvisers worry far too much about that. Just trust that you will do good stuff, and don't worry if a particular scene doesn't work. That's normal. The reason we don't remember them is because there's nothing to remember.
Have you had people that were way too extravagant? That were just trying maybe too hard?
That's a sign of nervousness, usually. Again, if you can get people to be calm and focused, you won't have those extremes. You won't have them freezing up out of panic, and you also won't have them going way over the top out of panic, right? People go to those extremes out of fear. Get rid of the fear, and people tend to be more normal and more grounded and create things that are fun to watch and interesting. The kind of overly bombastic big thing that they're trying to make up for the fact that they're feeling nervous and scared. So if you get them less nervous and scared, they'll be able to rein themselves in a little bit and just do the work, just do the improv, right? And same thing with people at the other end who kind of retreat into themselves. They do that, again, out of fear. So if you can get them to relax and have fun, then they'll come out of their shell. And the extroverts and the introverts and the boisterous people and the shy people will kind of meet in the middle and be able to perform together. And when that happens, it's kind of awesome and magical.
Do you find that you need to coax them into, like, say, coax the shy people into coming out of their shell more? Or do you find that if there's a, let's say, a large group, that it happens naturally, like you're saying?
It does happen by itself a bit, in that people, once they see other people doing things and realize There is no way to fail at it. I mean, it is what it is. You do what you do. They go, okay, I can do that. And they see that, and they begin to internalize that. But I also try and give positive feedback when I can and encourage them. And give if I give them nothing else, I try to give them confidence in themselves. Because if I can do that, everything else will follow on, right? So the most important thing is make them feel good about themselves, confident in the choices they're making, willing to try things, willing to take chances, knowing that they're in a safe environment where, you know, the worst that can possibly happen is the scene doesn't go that great. Nobody's going to die, right? It's like, eh, that particular scene wasn't so great. Get back up and do it again. One thing I say in my teaching quite often is a good improviser is someone who can do a not-so-great scene and get up right away for the next one without losing a beat. A great improviser can do an entire evening of really bad, boring scenes and come back the next night and do it all again, right? That's the mark of someone who has confidence in themselves and a willingness to keep on going and taking risks and taking chances, and that's how you get better.
Would you say that it's very different, the relationships that you have, say, with your coworkers or with the people that you work over, say, your students? How do you keep a good relationship with them, and what happens when they do something that is perhaps even dangerous? Maybe you're not in the biology lab, so it's perhaps not the same.
Yeah, we're not doing research into, like, you know, dangerous weapons and things. University, we're doing things like software development.
Yes.
It's hard to get injured doing software development. I mean, unless you drop a computer on your foot, you're not going to get hurt, right? So in that environment, it's very safe. And teaching improv, also very safe. People don't normally get injured. The physical stakes are very low. So I wouldn't worry about the danger aspect as much.
But what would you say to people who are working with people in those, say, more high-stake environments, in matter of physical environments, say, for example, in a biology lab, or
sure.
I'm throwing this like a fire station. Mm-hmm. Those are all places where you have to have very good relationships, especially with people, say, who are working in the medical emergency fields, like paramedics. The team that is working together needs to be cohesive in order to execute the things that they need to do in order to save people's lives.
A lot of it comes down to trust. Trusting the other person and trusting yourself, right? Trusting. In improv, we learn to trust our own instincts for what to do next in a scene, and also to trust our fellow performers and the information they give us. If we're doing a scene together in improv and you initiate something, I trust you 100%. I go, yes, I'm going to get on board with that idea. That's a good idea. I think for any team to work together, you have to do that. If the team is made of people who say, well, no, I want to do this. Well, I want to do that. I want to do this other thing. That's not really a team at all. That's people pulling in different directions. And particularly when the stakes are high, like firefighters or paramedics, you really want to work together as a team. And I think part of their training is how to do that effectively. Because I can't imagine paramedics not working together as a team because the stakes are way too high. I've never trained paramedics. I've never trained as a paramedic. But I can't imagine that they would get training that doesn't include some element of teamwork. And the skills from improv certainly teach teamwork because really when you're on an empty stage with no script, all you have is each other. So you learn to be very interdependent and connected to each other and to rely on each other and trust each other.
Those are very good points. In matter of trust, that really hit home in a way where it really gets to that something so simple as trust. And it's the building blocks of our humanity. If we're able to trust, and in a way, part of it is to allow ourselves almost to be embarrassed. Because I believe that many times when people are not trusting the other person, say in improv, it's because they're afraid that the other person or that they themselves will embarrass themselves.
And I think fear of embarrassment is something that a lot of people have, but you get over that with time. It's like any fear. If I were trying to get over a fear of spiders, for example, I might look at a picture of a spider, put that away, have some tea, relax, look at the picture again, it's a little better, right? Then I get a rubber spider, and eventually I could have a real tarantula crawling up my arm, and I'd be fine with it, because I've desensitized myself to that initial fear reaction. I think people can do that just by the experience of putting themselves out there and going, okay, that was a little bit embarrassing, but it's okay. You know, it was fun. I had a good time. Everyone enjoyed themselves. And being embarrassed isn't the end of the world, and you don't really get that embarrassed. It's It's a fear that is largely groundless, I would say. People go into it going, what if I make a mistake? What if I do something wrong? Well, in improv, there really aren't any mistakes. And because you don't know how it's supposed to go, there is no way it's supposed to go, any choice you make is a valid choice. So you can't really screw it up. The worst that happens is it doesn't really go anywhere. It's a little boring to watch. That's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is you create magic on stage. So the upside is great, and the downside is never that bad. So it's a very safe kind of activity.
There are people who go into improv, and there are improv spaces where there's alcohol, and there's beer and wine and whatever you'd like in order to help you relax, to help you perhaps not be embarrassed. Would you encourage that?
Nope. Because anything that impairs your judgment inhibits you as an improviser. You may feel better, but the actual process of listening, I mean, if you think of someone who's really drunk, they're not great at listening. Right? They're having trouble focusing at all. So I think anything that impairs your judgment or your perception, and that includes drugs and alcohol, do them after the show, not before or during the show. The audience may have a drink or two, that's fine, but the people on stage need to be clear-headed and not under the influence of anything in order to be able to do their best work.
Even if it's one glass and they're great at...
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people. Oh, well, it's only one glass of wine. Yeah, even so, I would say...
I don't drink at all, so...
I don't drink at all either, but there are people out there who do.
Yes.
I have no problem with their drinking. Just don't drink before getting on stage with me, because I would rather have someone completely clear and focused.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Would you say, perhaps, it's a question that just came up in my mind, that... Perhaps it's a good idea to do improv when you come back home with your family members to connect between the family, especially if it's younger children, but even teenagers who are having a hard time living together.
Sure. It's interesting because young children are natural improvisers. They play make-believe games all the time. No one teaches them to do that. They just know to do that. And so we unlearn that at a certain point in our lives. So relearning it is what improv is mostly about. Kids naturally imagine things, create things, tremendous creative potential that later on in life kind of gets discouraged and tamped down. If we can reconnect with that childhood glee, then we'll be good improvisers. As for teens getting along with each other, being a teenager is tough. I mean, there's so much, right? It's a hard time of life. And yeah, teenagers, especially siblings, are going to have conflict. Improv theoretically could help with that if they learn to listen, if they learn to say yes and to things. I think it can improve any kind of relationship, including the dynamic between siblings.
So you'd suggest perhaps parents to get their children over or teenagers to improv classes together?
Along with their parents, possibly, right? Bring everyone in and learn the skills. But it's easier to improvise with someone who knows how to do improv than with someone who doesn't. So if everyone kind of gets it and kind of understands the jargon, even if they never take a class, even if they just read a book on it, that'll give them the idea of it.
Mm-hmm. So this is a great segue to the end of our episode. I just wanted to ask you if you have any message that you would like to pass on to children or to youth nowadays, something that perhaps you would have wanted to, that you would know yourself perhaps years ago, or something that you see with all of your VR training and the development that you do, how to get that balance.
The one piece of advice I would give to almost anyone is believe in yourself. And I know that sounds very trite, I know people say that all the time, but it really is important. If you believe in your own potential, that'll motivate you and take you forwards. If you don't believe in yourself, then you'll lack the motivation and drive that it takes to achieve anything in life.
So kids, we suggest you to write down your goals and get to it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Bernie Roll.
My pleasure.
Glad to have you on Changemakers.